So now, yeah, the speaker for today is Lewis Todman. Lewis was once described, he tells me, as someone who was expelled from every university in Western Australia, leaving a trail of death and destruction in his wake. He also tells me that that's not true, so make of that whatever you will. As well as that, though, he's been an activist for years now. He's been part of refugee campaigning in Perth. He writes regularly for Red Flag, and he was a founder of the Perth branch of Socialist Alternative. And so Lewis is going to speak, and then after that, there will be time for discussion. And so if people, as Lewis is speaking, if you have questions that come up, points you want to raise in the discussion, try and think through those things, and then, yeah, we'll have discussion afterwards. But, yeah, it's Lewis.
Okay, thanks. All right, I just want to start with a story of one Syrian refugee who filmed her journey to Europe, a journey that millions of people like her have taken. Rania Mustafa Ali, you might have actually seen her story, they made a little documentary out of it, is a 20-year-old Kurdish refugee from Aleppo. Her hometown has been reduced to rubble. To escape from Syria, Rania paid a smuggler to take her to Turkey and then boarded a tiny, overcrowded dinghy with about 50 other people, the boat was probably suitable for about 10 people, to cross the Mediterranean. Not long into their journey, the boat began capsizing, the people at the back began yelling out that they were drowning, and fortunately they were rescued. But they were lucky. In 2017 alone, at least 3,100 migrants drowned trying to cross the Mediterranean. That's about 1 in 18 people who attempted the crossing. And the Italian Coast Guard has not only refused to help, they've actually frozen the assets and seized ships from Doctors Without Borders for rescuing drowning refugees. After being taken to Greece, Rania was joined by thousands of others in a tent city. They tried to cross the border into Macedonia, which was defended with razor wire and tanks. Along with thousands of others, Rania was beaten and tear-gassed. And eventually, she was only able to make it to Austria via a plane with a false passport, where she was able to apply for asylum. Around the world, borders are going up for people like Rania. Europe's razor wire and tear gas, Trump's border wall and child separations, Australia's concentration camps on Manus and Nauru. The global working class, particularly people of colour from poorer nations, face a system of violent and authoritarian borders that decide the terms on which they can move from one part of the world to another. Most of the time, they can leave their country of origin only so long as they provide some economic benefit to the capitalist class. The length of their stay and their working rights are heavily constrained. Those who cross borders illegally, whether they are fleeing wars or just seeking a better life, do so at extreme personal risk and are denied basic rights in their country of settlement. But meanwhile, the global capitalist class plays by a very different set of rules. Investor class visas enable the rich to bypass the barriers that others face. So you can actually be granted permanent residency in the United States just for investing $500,000. Money searches the globe for weak regulations and cheap labour. Resources are sucked from one part of the world and sold in another. Factories are shut down and reopened elsewhere. So in 2017, $1.5 trillion was able to cross borders. The debate about borders is often posed as one between hard right nationalists who favour immigration restrictions and liberal centrists who want porous borders. But this is completely false. Trump ramped up the brutality, but under Obama, funding for immigration enforcement actually increased 30% and millions of people were deported. On Trump's current plans to build the wall, the Democrats don't actually object to the principle of the wall. They just think that the money could be spent on other forms of border protection. And in case you didn't make the connection, they make it for us. They actually call it a smart wall. That's their proposal. And the same goes for the European Union, which is supposedly some progressive institution. They may have let some refugees in 2015, but they quickly closed the borders. And the much celebrated relative freedom of movement within Europe's borders is the counterpart to barbed wire, tear gas, beatings and drownings in the Mediterranean and on the outer borders. All borders are a tool of the capitalist class to divide us, to exploit us and deny us rights. They deny the world's poor their fundamental right to move and live where they want. And they can be torn down. So this talk is an argument to abolish borders and for freedom of movement for the entire global working class. Okay, so just a little bit of history. First, the strict border controls that we see today are a relatively recent historical invention. Passports, for instance, didn't exist until late in the 19th century, and they weren't universally required for international travel until World War I, when ruling classes started being more interested in who was moving across borders. And so border controls are really bound up with the rise of capitalism and the nation state. Europe in the 18th century was a patchwork of around 300 princedoms, duchies, kingdoms, and free cities. I don't know what half of those things are. But with the rise of capitalism, a series of wars and revolutions consolidated this patchwork into modern nation states. The nation state suited the outlook and the economic interests of the new ruling class, the capitalist ruling class. They had one home market with a common language to facilitate trade. Customs, borders, and armies regulated the terms of competition with other blocks of capitalists from other countries. And the ideology of nationalism fostered the illusion that everyone within a nation, poor and rich alike, had a common history, values, and destiny. Capitalism, from its inception, subordinated human movement in various ways to the needs of the market to an unprecedented degree. Millions of African slaves were forcibly moved to the Americas. Millions of Europeans migrated to the colonies, killing and displacing the native inhabitants. And in the 20th century, the ruling class began to take a greater interest in who moved across national borders, in particular, restricting migration from the former colonies to the global north. So borders between nations are often thought to represent kind of natural cultural units. But I think the fluidity of national borders over time, like I talked about going from 300 states to like what we have today in Europe, and their origins in early capitalism disproves this. In particular, the borders in the former colonial world are just even more authoritarian. So Most African and Middle Eastern nations were literally just drawn on a map by their former colonial masters during the colonial period. Okay, so border controls today, what purpose do they serve for capitalism? Modern border controls regulate labour flows in the interests of the capitalist class, and they stratify the workforce into groups with more or less rights, depending on their residency status. Capitalism needs to reduce human beings to the status of cogs in a machine. Human dreams, desires, and freedoms need to be subordinate to the needs of profit-making. And immigration controls are a mechanism to carry out this subordination. They control who can move, where they can move, and the terms on which they do. Borders aren't just physical barriers. They're the sharp edge of a legal framework that gives different rights to different sections of the workforce, depending on their nationality and residency status. So undocumented workers, or those on temporary visas, have less rights than citizens, and it's quite common for them to be deported or threatened with deportation for standing up for their rights. I just want to give one example of that. So a group of cleaners at the University of London had like a protracted fight against outsourcing from 2009 to 2017. And at the beginning of their battle, the residency status of some of them was used to criminalise the strikers and deport a bunch of them. So I'll just read out a description from an article of what happened. Early in their campaign, their employer summoned them to a meeting. Doors were blocked, and when employers' representatives mentioned the phrase immigration papers, immigration officials in riot gear stormed in. Nine cleaning staff were bundled into lockups and then onto planes. Here, one vignette is the border busy at work. It's not out there invisibly hugging the coastline. It's here invading our communities and workplaces. But on a happy note, the striking cleaners eventually defeated a multinational corporation and the university and won their battle against outsourcing, despite their oppression. So guest worker visas, like the 482 visas that we have in Australia, regulate the terms on which people can move around the globe. The first such visas were introduced in the 1970s, but they're now standard completely across the board in wealthy countries. These visas plug skills shortages with high-skilled and educated workers in more technical industries, as well as providing bosses with a low-paid workforce in relatively unskilled work like fruit picking. And the benefit to the capitalist class is immense. In skilled work, Australian bosses get to benefit from the skills of overseas workers without the Australian state having to pay a cent for their education. Human beings are treated like any other raw material. They're shipped in for a couple of years when demand is high and then discarded. Temporary worker programs tie workers' residency status to their employment, giving their bosses massive power over their lives. This puts up an extra barrier to organizing resistance. So last year, a study was done on temporary farm workers in Australia, which found a majority were paid beneath the legal minimum, and almost a third earned less than $12 an hour. Asian workers reported that they were subject to shouting and abuse from their bosses, while the European workers were not, and that they were paid less than the Europeans. The farms lacked basic amenities like water and toilets. So this is all technically illegal, so they're supposed to be paid the same rates as Australian workers, but workers commonly reported a fear of being fired or deported if they spoke up. There are other rorts too. So international students are hugely profitable for Australian universities. Education is now Australia's fourth biggest export. International students have major restrictions on their working hours, which means they're often forced to work informal and cash-in-hand jobs. And people have probably seen scandals like people being paid a dollar an hour at 7-Eleven. and meanwhile, the Australian bosses get to pick the most talented students from Asia and the rest are sent home. In some countries, there's a huge layer of workers with no legal residency at all. In the USA, there's somewhere between 3 and 12 million undocumented workers, and they make up some 15% of the farm workforce there. Conferring illegality onto these workers is a way to ensure they have no legal rights whatsoever, and they can be threatened with deportation if they step out of line. So walls, barbed wire, riot police, tear gas, bullets, deportations, and detention camps control the movement of the global working class. And these are the essential reinforcements of the legal stratification between citizens and illegals, between permanent and temporary residents, which determines the terms on which the global working class can move and the rights that they have. So the border really does reach into every community and workplace. Okay. So the capitalist class treats workers as commodities. But they also live in fear of the global working class because of their power to unite and overthrow them. And so they seek to prevent their aggregation by any means necessary. To this end, border controls serve a crucial ideological role for capitalism, stoking racism and nationalist sentiment against workers from other countries. Nationalism is a key ideological prop of capitalism. It binds workers to the ruling class via loyalty to the nation. So we're taught to see the success of our nation in war, in economic competition, or in sport as our own success. This blunts class consciousness and obscures who our real enemies are and who our real allies are. Politicians and the rich have always cynically used nationalism and racism to try to convince us to identify with our rulers rather than our class, and to direct our animosity towards workers of other nations. So way back in 1870, Marx described the effect of anti-Irish prejudice, which I'm going to quote because it's very familiar to what we see today. The ordinary English worker hates the... this is the quote. The ordinary English worker hates the Irish worker as a competitor who forces down the standard of life. In relation to the Irish worker, he feels himself to be a member of the ruling nation, and therefore makes himself a tool of his aristocrats and capitalists against Ireland, thus strengthening their domination over himself. This antagonism is artificially kept alive by and intensified by the press, the pulpit, the comic papers, by all the means at the disposal of the ruling class. So, pretty much what we see today. So these days, a series of baseless racist tropes are used by the ruling class in much the same way that Marx described 150 years ago. Fundamentalist Christian politicians tell us that Muslims don't respect women and LGBTI people. Billionaire media moguls who treat their workers like dirt warn that immigrants are going to take our jobs. And these people are going to protect us by protecting the borders. Border controls are obviously racist. Most of the people being excluded from wealthy nations are from Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. These are the people that Western nations have colonized, robbed, waged war on, and dehumanized since the birth of capitalism. Most are trying to escape poverty caused by Western imperialist robbery or by wars waged by our governments or their proxies. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were only possible because of the great efforts put in by politicians and the media to dehumanize Muslims. But this racism, they've sort of taken it and run with it, because it's also been used to stoke racism and fear. And fear of Muslim immigration is now a key ideological prop of the right. This ideological and political dimension of border protection takes on a life of its own. Politicians compete for who can dehumanize refugees the most. Centrist politicians who one year warned of the dangers of immigration, the next year find themselves losing out to far-right politicians who take the racism to its logical conclusion. And this process has turned cruelty and inhumanity from a side effect of border control to a deliberate and celebrated policy. The reason that the ruling class is so intent on fostering racism is because the working class has the potential to unite against them. Despite all attempts to divide the working class, to stratify us into different legal categories, to poison workers' minds with hatred and fear of foreigners, resistance to racism and borders are a constant feature of our society. This is because all workers are exploited and oppressed by the capitalist class, albeit to different degrees. And we can only improve our lot by banding together. That's why unions in Australia at their best have been at the forefront of anti-racist struggles. And farm workers in Australia have been organising to defend themselves. In the USA, migrants are the fastest growing category of unionists. And throughout some of the difficult periods of for unionism in the United States, they've been the only section of the workforce that's the only section of the union movement that's been growing. Militant workers have also taken up issues of racism outside the workplace. And one stunning example of this solidarity took place on Australia's waterfront in the late 40s after World War II, which I want to talk about because it relates to my hometown in Perth. at this time, the Dutch were waging a war against Indonesian nationalists who were struggling for independence from their colonial masters. As soon as the war for independence began, Australian waterfront workers declared their solidarity with the Indonesians and refused to handle any Dutch shipping. They did this in defiance of the Labor government. In Fremantle, in Western Australia, where I live, a Dutch naval base was attached to the port, but no Dutch ships were able to dock, and one submarine had to be sunk because dock workers refused to repair it, and the Communist Union official, Paddy Troy, had the pleasure of having it sunk and used as a breakwater on the beach. In Fremantle. And this has all taken place during the period of the White Australia policy, so that's pretty significant. Now, this remarkable show of solidarity did not happen automatically. It took a political fight. The leader of the Dockworkers Union in Fremantle was a rotten Labour Party member who opposed the boycott on the grounds of mateship with the Dutch, but not the Indonesians, apparently. One of his organisers, a Communist Party militant called Paddy Troy, who I mentioned just a second ago, led a fight to win a majority of union members to support the Indonesians, and he was able to win, and no one, not a single member of the union, would touch any Dutch ship. Similar debates are taking place on the left today, and we want to be the ones who consistently take the side of the global working class and against borders. So I'll talk about that a little bit. So some left social democrat politicians, like Bernie Sanders, Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France, and to a lesser extent Jeremy Corbyn in Britain, have denounced open borders as a neoliberal device to attack workers' rights. They support immigration controls as a means to protect native-born workers' interests against the importation of cheap foreign labour. So this is absolute garbage. It's not the presence of workers from other countries that undermines union organising, wages and conditions. It's their criminalisation or the conference of less rights. So I just want to give one example that I think highlights it really well. I stole it from a talk by Justin Akershikon. I hope he's not here. In the USA, between 1965 and 1985, wages for undocumented workers were almost on parity with those of legal American workers. So why is this? Well, the border was not militarized the way it is today, and it was not illegal to hire an undocumented worker. So even without citizenship and the usual rights that gives people, their relative freedom of movement gave undocumented workers far more bargaining power than they have today. that in 1986, the Immigration Reform and Control Act poured money into border militarisation, placed greater sanctions on bosses who hired undocumented workers, which of course was never enforced against the bosses, and they allowed emergency raids to arrest and deport undocumented workers. So from 1986 to 1993, wages for undocumented workers fell 35%. At the same time that that was passed, 2 million undocumented workers were given amnesty, thanks, and were made legal citizens, given a path to citizenship. Their wages went up 15% between 1986 and 2000. So the facts are pretty clear. When workers have more rights, wages go up. When they have less rights, when they're threatened with deportation, when the borders are militarized so they can't go back and forth as they will, wages go down. It's pretty straightforward. A related assumption is that workers from poorer countries will automatically accept mistreatment because they just come from poverty and they're used to it. But this is just racist, and it's pretty quickly refuted by a quick glance at Australian history. It's not a coincidence that so many of the greatest rebels in Australian history were Irish, from Ned Kelly to Paddy Troy, the Fremantle communist militant who I mentioned a second ago. The Irish were mistreated, they hated the British Empire, and they often brought radical political traditions from their home country. Or take the Ford Broadmeadows factory in Melbourne, which is famous for its militancy, where 15 different languages were spoken and the workers were led by a Greek shop steward and so on. You can pretty much think of a million examples. Like, migrant workers in Australia usually have been the ones who are more radical than Australian workers and have been pushing Australians in the right direction. Okay. The centre-left often couch their opposition to open borders in terms of realism. So they say they want to steer a sensible middle ground between the racist hard right and a kind of unbridled immigration that would burden infrastructure and the welfare state. But these supposedly realistic fears are actually just pure fantasy. So even in its highest point, in 2015, Europe's refugee intake was 3 million. This is just a drop in the ocean in a continent of 741 million people, where 5 million people are born each year. It's actually just not a lot of people. But if we leave our criticism at that, I think we need to go a lot further, because that accepts a moral framework that dehumanizes migrants. So the assumption in the debate a lot of the time is that immigration is desirable only if it has a positive fiscal balance. That is, immigrants are welcome if they improve the economic situation of the current inhabitants. But if not, they must be excluded. And this is precisely the grounds on which the Australian government now is carrying out, has actually carried out a bunch of deportations or attempted deportations. So right now, there's a family, the Wang Chuck family, who have lived in Australia since 2012. They're from Bhutan. And they're now facing deportation on grounds that their deaf son is a burden on the Australian taxpayer. If anyone were to apply this logic to any other group in society, it would universally be considered barbaric. So if someone were to argue we should deport people who are older than 70 because they're likely to cost the taxpayer more than they put back, they would just be condemned universally. Likewise, if someone said you're only allowed to move from Perth to Sydney if you're facing dire political persecution and you go through the proper channels and not just because you'd like to get a better job, anyone would think that that is absurd. And the fact that these arguments are taken seriously when it comes to immigration is just purely a product of the dehumanisation of migrants. So we should reject that whole premise and support freedom of movement as a right. So we in Socialist Alternative stand unequivocally for open borders. We were there at the Woomera and Baxter detention centres where the combined efforts of refugees and their supporters tore down the fences and freed them. We were there at Lady Salenta Hospital when a refugee was to be deported to Nauru, and together with other activists, we blockaded the hospital and prevented the deportation. And we were also there. Jasmine pretty much said the story. Actually, I wasn't going to say a lot. But in 2016, a Monash Uni academic and his family, who'd lived here for 9 years, were threatened with deportation on grounds that their autistic son was a burden on the Australian taxpayer. And Socialist Alternative members led a campaign for that family to stay, which Jasmine was really central to, apparently, winning the support of the student and staff unions, and we were able to stop that deportation. Okay, so borders are a tool for the capitalist class to divide us and control our movement. They are not a natural and timeless feature of human society, but a creation of the particular way capitalism organises exploitation globally today. Borders reduce human dreams and desires to the needs of the market, and they trample on our fundamental right to move, live, and work where we want. If we're on the side of the working class against the capitalist class, the side of humanity against the market, we must be for open borders. We should not make a distinction between refugees fleeing wars and so-called economic refugees, i.e. those fleeing poverty. We should not make a distinction between refugees who flee through the ordinary channels, orderly channels, and those who pay smugglers. Everyone should have the right to move. Because the borders serve the interests of our oppressors, in periods of mass social struggle and revolution, ordinary people can tear down the borders that separate them. 30 years ago, thousands of people descended on the Berlin Wall from both sides and broke it apart. In 2011, during the early days of the Libyan Revolution, the border with revolutionary Egypt was thrown open by the people on either side. Countless breathless journalists reported their shock and excitement at simply walking across the line and being warmly greeted by smiling young people saying, "Welcome to free Libya." But this liberation was short-lived, just a few weeks, as the counter-revolution clamped down on both sides of the border. In these brief glimpses of a new world, where the working class has taken control of their destiny and begun to tear apart the capitalist system, they've also begun to tear down the borders that divide them. Capitalism subordinates human freedom to the needs of the market. If we want to win a free world, a world without borders, we need to abolish capitalism. So we want to tear down the walls. We want the bricks and mortar to crumble to sand. We want the metal to rust. And we want the idea that any person should not be able to live where they choose to be consigned to the history books, along with the system that spawned it. Thanks.